23. See no evil, hear no evil. The top brass take the stand. 2019 to 2020. It's almost 8 months into the Royal Commission hearings when those who matter most to the Lawyer X story are called to give evidence. Their testimony is largely overlooked at the time due to the nation's preoccupation with the bushfire crisis. But their evidence shouldn't be ignored. The witness box of a royal commission is historically unkind to Victoria's police chief commissioners, yet Graham Ashton seems unflustered. For almost a year, he has maintained he did nothing wrong in relation to the Gobbo scandal. He was the first police officer to publicly do so. He openly confronted the High Court's finding of reprehensible behaviour. In the witness box, he sits calmly, bar the odd leg jiggle. He avoids the combat pose of some Royal Commission witnesses. He never gets animated in public, whether in open court or on talkback radio. He appears unfazed on this day in December 2019 when his memory conflicts with the documented evidence. If Ashton doesn't play poker, he should start. Ashton was the assistant director at the Office of Police Integrity during the Informer 3838 years. He was mandated to investigate corruption within the force. Gobbo's use as an informer was plainly wrong, but Ashton identified nothing at the time to warrant scrutiny. There wasn't anything at play suggesting there was any integrity or misconduct concerns, Ashton says. So you're not prepared to concede to this Royal Commission that it would have been advisable for you to do a little bit of probing just to find out what was going on? Chris Winnicky asks. With the information that I think was available to me at that time, I don't think I did the wrong thing. Ashton explains that he was late to the Gobbo informing secret, if 12 years ahead of the Victorian public, but he knew about her odd behaviour as a lawyer long before he learned of the bigger deceit. Ashton asked questions about the defence barrister soon after the killings of Terry and Christine Hodson in 2004. He heard Gobbo was probably sleeping with the chief suspect, Detective Paul Dale. He also suspected that Gobbo had passed on intelligence reports about Terry Hodson's police informing to the underworld, leading to the Hodson murders. He wanted her to face coercive questioning under oath in 2006 and 2007. But like so many other police investigators, he appears to have been stymied in his pursuit of the truth by the very force he now commands. All the evidence points to his withdrawing Gobbo from the 2006 compulsory hearing because Assistant Commissioner Simon Overland asked him to. This would mean that the fierce independence of the OPI got lost in Victoria police politics. The protections supposedly offered by an independent overseer dissolved when a senior police officer begged a favour. Yet Ashton cannot recall why the OPI hearings were called off. He plays down his relationship with Overland. It was a good working relationship, he says, that did not veer towards a social friendship. He says he didn't know about Gobbo's informing until a year later, in 2007, when Gobbo was eventually examined and the OPI hearing was abandoned, for unknown reasons, after she was warned she was being untruthful. That's how he remembers it, Ashton says. And so what if a mountain of documents suggests otherwise? He seems unmoved by questions about his not keeping a diary when he was at the OPI. It is standard practice for police officers to keep a diary across the Western world. Notes protect police officers from nefarious speculations fostered in the absence of written documentation. Ashton was asked why he had not mentioned Gobbo's 1999 period of informing during the secret Ghanaian trial in 2016 and 2017. It hadn't occurred to him, he said. But he does have concessions to make. He has jettisoned his high-risk decisions in high-risk times language in response to Gobbo's exposure in December 2018. He sought then only to explain his officers' thinking, not excuse their behaviour, he now says. When he accepted the top job in 2015, he named the Hodson killings as a case he was determined to crack. Yet in the witness box, Ashton speaks about the internal police machinations that help explain why it remains unsolved to this day. Call him the outsider. Sir Ken Jones wanted to move to Australia because the idea appealed to his family. The British police officer's work had already taken him to Hong Kong and Zimbabwe. He applied to be Victoria Police's chief commissioner after Christine Nixon announced her retirement in 2008. The outsider was a big chance. He was interviewed as one of the final two applicants by Premier John Brumby. A few weeks after Deputy Commissioner Simon Overland was chosen as top cop, he then accepted an offer to join Victoria Police as Overland's deputy. He's never got over it. Jones admired many aspects of Victoria Police culture on his arrival, but he questioned others. His foreign perspective was unwelcome. He grated on the ingrained culture. Within 6 months, according to him, Overland was trying to sideline him by relocating his office. By then, Jones was already arranging an exit strategy from Victoria Police. He resigned in 2011, then was told to leave before he had seen out his notice. Overland reported him to the OPI because Overland believed Jones was leaking to the media and undermining him. Jones felt completely and utterly humiliated. His phone was bugged, his reputation tarnished. His wife's mental health collapsed after a red laser rifle sighter was trained on the couple while they walked their dog along the Tan track in South Yarra. These experiences explain why the outsider sits in the Royal Commission witness box, as opposed to giving video evidence from his home in the United Kingdom. He wants to confront the demons in person and set the record straight. Jones has a clipped beard and wears a striped tie. He presents as neat and precise. The outsider offers unsettling perspectives about the inside of Victoria Police. He wants the world to know that Victoria Police was toxic, dysfunctional, and wrong. He seeks to right the wrongs that cost him so much. He says the police bureaucracy was driven by absolute loyalty to the boss. Some junior officers made choices that conflicted with their professional ethics. Tracking waste and accountability was like knitting fog. Jones wondered at joint investigations by Victoria Police and the Office of Police Integrity. How could the regulator work alongside the regulated? They sank or swam together, it seemed. Jones didn't become aware of Gobbo's informing until 2010, after the death of Carl Williams. He joined a small list of private naysayers. To him, her informing was nothing less than the industrial abuse of the criminal justice process. It quickly descended into chaos, he says in the witness box. By the time the train had run away from them, they didn't know how to stop it. At the time, after Williams's death in 2010, Jones consulted a retired judge, then the Ombudsman's Office, which he felt did not grasp the wrongness of Gobbo's use as an informer. Jones believed some police officers had perjured themselves. He queried the swift payout of the 2010 civil suit launched by Gobbo. Yet he did not speak to his boss, Simon Overland, about his concerns. He says he sought independent scrutiny that would not tip off those suspected of improper behaviour. Jones says the Hodson murder investigation was hamstrung by internal police secrets that amounted to an unforgivable betrayal. As for the Carl Williams murder, Jones speculates that it was pre-planned. He oversaw Task Force Driver, which investigated the prison killing, and concludes the murder involved corrupt actors inside and outside the prison. Jones said he held concerns that investigators had found 9 dormant bugs illegally installed in Williams's Acacia Unit 1. His statement is unequivocal. On the face of it, the Williams murder was unimaginable, in that the most important state witness in the history of Victoria could be murdered within the most secure unit, which itself was located within our most secure prison. Speaking of the phone tap he was subjected to after his removal, Jones describes a police culture of secrecy and paranoia, hopelessly clouded by petty personal sensitivities and concerns. It does sound extraordinary that a former deputy commissioner's phone was bugged over such flimsy preoccupations as media leaks. As for keeping a police diary, it's accepted practice across the world. Not to keep one could expose you to claims of corruption, he says. Of course, Jones kept a diary. Nicola Gobbo has spoken. Not at the Royal Commission, where she would be confronted with criminal allegations, but to a news crew instead. The ABC announces the TV interview early on the morning of the 10th of December, 2019. It becomes the talking point of the Royal Commission hearing room. Why is Gobbo talking to the media, but refusing to talk to the powers that matter? Close observers suggest that McMurdo has rejected Gobbo's claims of ill health. Gobbo, it said, is retaliating. So Gobbo speaks, on her terms. There is a last-minute flick of the hair and an uncertain darting of her eyes as an ABC producer theatrically snaps a clapboard and announces that the camera is rolling. "It's complicated," Gobbo begins. She presents a measured candor in choosing her words. Her reflections seem hard-earned, as if it is time to dispel the almost daily allegations from the Royal Commission. Yet her choice of forum invites more questions than answers. Carlyon and Dowsley knew they would never get to interview Gobbo. She holds Dowsley personally responsible for her plight. But they have often spitballed the questions they would ask her. They could be reduced to three. Why? Any regrets? And what the hell were you doing in the months before the Hodgsons were killed? By giving a TV interview, Gobbo avoids the exacting details that Dowsley and Carlyon seek to understand. Gobbo instead perpetuates her victimhood line, unfettered by the inconvenient facts that contradict her chosen narrative. Gobbo says she was extorted by the criminals, then extorted by the police. It's not the first time that they, Victoria Police, threaten me in relation to towing the line and doing things their way, or they would take my children, Gobbo tells the ABC. She has claimed such concerns since 2015. It remains their, her children's, belief that they were chased out of their home by police that are trying to take their mummy away, and that, to any parent, is beyond devastating. Gobbo's life is hellish. Physical pain is compounded by threats to her safety. She is stranded and stateless, she says, fed to the wolves by Victoria Police. In words later stridently condemned by the police association, Gobbo says, "There's always going to be a safety risk, but my greatest fear is the police themselves." After his second day of evidence to the Royal Commission, Chief Commissioner Graham Ashton is compelled to address Gobbo's claims. "She need not fear police," he says. "They are doing everything they can to keep Gobbo safe." So how much of Gobbo's take on historical events is accurate? Her ABC TV interview is a terrific journalistic scoop, hard-earned and well-executed, but lacking the controls for an unvarnished rendering of her state of mind. Dowsley and Carlyon are frustrated that they cannot put forward supplementary questions in response to her answers. For example, Gobbo speaks of people being murdered and police threats compelling her to continue to inform. Yet she also says her assistance morphed into a dependence upon Victoria Police. And we know that Gobbo kept offering up information, even after she was officially jettisoned by Victoria Police in 2009 and again in 2010. The two positions, threats and dependence, do not bind readily. Her reasoning from 1995 to 2012 needs to be tackled over many hours to make sense of her choices. "It began as a moral and ethical dilemma for me," she tells the ABC interviewer, harking back to the same issues that prompted her to contact the AFP in 1998 about becoming an informer. Gobbo didn't like her criminal surrounds within a month of becoming a barrister. This is easy to understand. What is not is that Gobbo did not absent herself from those surrounds over the next 13 years. Gobbo's well-being once relied upon deceiving drug barons and speed freaks. Her gift for lying, or what she has called plausible deniability, is why she is still alive today. Gobbo speaks to the ABC of suing Victoria Police for personal injury against herself and her two children. Her greatest source of guilt, she says, is the impact on her children. Finding sympathy for her daily privations of pain and dislocation is not difficult. Less easy to embrace is Gobbo's blaming of others. She portrays herself as misused and manipulated, whereas the police have cast her as an informer and a suspect, most notably for her proximity to two gangland hits, the Hodsons and Jason Moran, and four deaths. Gobbo deflects questions that contradict her projection of herself as a victim. She denies that she burgled the office of a colleague in 2007. Yet she is not confronted with the documents suggesting that she bragged about the break-in to her police handlers. We can compare Gobbo's statements on the ABC to chats she had with Dowsley in 2014. She denied to him that she was an informer. She also denied sleeping with Paul Dale, though she now tells the ABC they were romantically intimate, once, a claim Dale supports. Gobbo bats away the questions she does not want to answer, ironically, by claiming that the answers are only for the ears of the Royal Commission that she does not want to appear at. She has neither the time nor concentration to prepare for such a grilling, she says. As the Royal Commission points out, however, Gobbo has had lots of time. The Commission has waited for her statement since March this year, and offstage seethes about her TV interview. Ms. Gobbo has been represented at community expense and continues to be represented throughout the life of this Commission at virtually all its hearings by solicitors and by both junior and senior counsel, a Commission spokeswoman says. Whilst Ms. Gobbo's lawyers commenced preparing a statement on her behalf, it was not completed. Gobbo has spoken, choosing to make a very different kind of statement. But the bigger questions still shimmer in a haze of doubt. Why did she inform to police for three separate periods between 1995 and 2009, starting with a sting on her then-housemate? How does she defend the mounting raft of criminal claims, from fraud to worse, of which she now stands accused? These questions can be addressed only when Gobbo talks, on terms not of her making. Gobbo has spoken to the Royal Commission in 2019, but no one knew about it at the time. Three phone conversations have taken place in March, April, and June, respectively. She did not swear to tell the truth, as she would have in the witness box. Time was short. The three calls lasted about 6 hours in total. She popped a painkiller every 2 hours to dull her chronic facial pain. Her memory, understandably, was patchy on details. Despite the context, she would describe the first chat as the most stimulating conversation I've had in months and months. "G'day, Nicola," Winicky opened with a casualness that defied the old-world customs of courtrooms. To her, he would be Chris. Gobbo had a lot to say about her voluntary second job, much of it in conflict with the prevailing Victoria Police line. Like them, she was not about to take responsibility for the appalling breaches of legal process. But she was prepared to blame police for threatening her. She is the weapon they couldn't stop wielding. Take Mick Gatto. Gobbo said one of her handlers had suggested she sleep with him to build his trust. Take one for the team, she says he urged, in just another allegation that highlighted her status as a lone female in a swamp of men. She'd wondered at the start how and when her informing would end. Well, that was the problem, she told Winicky. As time went on, they kept coming up with new people and targets that they were specifically interested in. She recalled the depth of the subterfuge, like the time officers raided her office for documents. It was a sham raid that had ended with detectives sitting around drinking coffee. Gobbo would have provided the documents, but police needed it to appear as if they had grabbed them by force. By the end of the third conversation, Gobbo's evidence was still incomplete. There was never going to be enough time. But she did express a regret. Her stroke in 2004 was a wake-up call. She should have taken a step back. But I didn't. It's painful sitting in the Royal Commission gallery. The hard chairs yield little comfort over the long hours. The middle back starts to protest, first with a niggle that cannot be stretched away, then a chronic ache, in a kind of symptom of the inexorable volume of material to be scrutinised by the inquiry. Yet the gallery seats are nothing like the trials in the witness box. You are captive. There is nowhere to go. The level of detail asked for requires memory and patience, and both are bound to elude you at times. It is a perch that no one wants to try, certainly not former Chief Commissioner Simon Overland. Noel Ashby stares at the man only a few feet from him in the witness box. Ashby has spent many years wondering about Overland, who investigated Ashby, then Assistant Commissioner, in 2007. Even instigated an Office of Police Integrity investigation to tap his phones and laid unsuccessful criminal charges against him. But Overland isn't interested in Ashby. He is a solitary figure in a room buzzing with 22 lawyers, like a giraffe gazing down at the zebras. Overland is the most significant figure in this forum, bar Nicola Gobbo herself. They never met, but Overland supervised her unholy relationship with Victoria Police, built on a shared desire to jail gangland figures. Overland has had a tough year, including accusations of historical missteps concerning the use of Gobbo and his sacking as a local council chief executive just a week ago. He has never relished close scrutiny. But he defies expectations on his first day of evidence. He appears relaxed in the witness box, even risking a few lighter moments. He seems to know what he wants to say. His evidence is imparted so uneventfully that a man in the gallery falls asleep. In 2005, he had never before heard of a barrister who was also an informer, but Gobbo's circumstances were extreme. She faced a death sentence, one way or another, because of her intimate relationships with criminals. Overland argues that Gobbo's informer registration was the least worst decision based on the information. He didn't intervene because he did not want to be in a witness box answering questions about her death. He says he cannot recall whether he knew Gobbo was representing Tony Mockbell in a high-profile 2006 drug case, while his officers used her in a sting aimed at collapsing the Mockbell empire. Winicky suggests Overland put his head in the sand, which Overland denies. He did not know she was breaching legal professional privilege, he says, challenging all common sense. Winicky allows himself a brief moment of incredulity, then shows Overland a 2006 newspaper article that quotes him alongside a photo of gangland lawyer Gobbo, helpfully captioned as one of Tony Mockbell's barristers. Yet Overland maintains that public references to Gobbo as Mockbell's lawyer escaped his notice. He was too busy. Winicky reaches for the obvious conclusion. Overland's claim of ignorance beggars belief. Cross-examining Overland, Chris Winicky QC is almost knockabout in his style, using lots of yes and alrights. He doesn't do condescending. He rarely raises his voice. He charts a course and won't be distracted. "They need a prick up there," says one vested observer during a break of Winicky's council-assisting role. He wants Overland savaged, but they don't have a prick up there. Instead, Winicky is the barrister's equivalent of Glenn McGrath, the former fast bowler. He puts the questions on a line and length with a relentless constancy that can induce impatience at their sameness. Overland discovers this on his second day on the stand, when he admits that Gobbo's use may have been a perversion of justice. He doesn't need to say what comes next, but speaks as if he ought to concede something. "I certainly agree that the ethics were fucked," he says, drawing on Gobbo's own language to her police handlers in 2006. But like Ashton, Nixon, and every other police officer in the witness box, Overland is not about to accept responsibility for Victoria Police's behaviour. By the end of his second day of evidence, Overland's position is becoming clearer. He says he was not kept abreast of intricate operational details that go to the ethics and legality of Gobbo's use. In the Herald Sun, Dowsley and Carlyon reduce Overland's evidence to a few simple sentences. "I solved the gangland war, but I wasn't across the details. My investigators made choices without my knowledge, and they possibly broke the law, but I did not fail in my leadership. I was concerned and surprised by the registration of Gobbo as informer 3838 in 2005. But yes, the documents show I was across her registration within days, if not earlier." If Overland's recollections sound unlikely, his evidence is about to be torpedoed on another front. His insistence that he did not keep written records is smashed about half an hour before he finishes his evidence, just before the Christmas break. It is 44 degrees outside, the sky tinged red by the lifted dust of bushfires. The assembled journalists are salivating over imagined beers. Then the story of the day happens. "No, I didn't keep a diary," Overland has said repeatedly. But his former chief of staff, Shane Patton, has remembered differently, telling Victoria Police his boss did keep a diary. A renewed hunt leads once again to the Laverton storage facility west of Melbourne, where Gobbo's 1995 informer registration lay unnoticed for almost a generation. Laverton has echoes of Area 51, the United States Air Force base in Nevada, thought to contain extraordinary secrets. In an overlooked box, labelled miscellaneous, lie blue hardback books embossed with the Victoria Police insignia. They are Overland's diaries from 2003, 2004, and 2007. Overland did keep diaries after all. And their contents will conflict with much of what Overland has said in the witness box. His recall of events until now has seemed disingenuous. He has a month to reconsider his evidence. Sergeant Schultz, from TV comedy Hogan's Heroes, does not appear by name in the Royal Commission's transcripts. But former Chief Commissioner Christine Nixon channels his ghost when she gives evidence. She offers the most credible of excuses when asked about the use of a defence barrister as a police informer. She knew nothing. Why didn't she know? Nixon doesn't know. She brings to mind the Socratic paradox, "I know that I know nothing." Nixon did not know about Gobbo's pivotal use in the discovery of the world's then biggest ecstasy bust in 2007, and the prosecution of Gobbo's own clients in the case. Nixon is poised and considered, as always, yet the content of her evidence conflicts with her presentation. She seems to know less about Lawyer X than the average radio talkback listener. The obvious reason? Her once subordinate Simon Overland never told her. Nixon is at ease describing organizational charts of Victoria Police hierarchies from various eras. She speaks of management reforms aimed at overcoming cultural isolation. This is her language, the preserve of company boardrooms, and it is foreign to the splatter and stench of a murder scene. She is evidently proud of her efforts to stem drug squad corruption after taking over in 2001. Yet the public face of the force, presented on TV to deflect bad news, says she didn't know about the biggest corruption of all. Nixon had seen Gobbo on TV, walking into court with clients. She knew Gobbo was to be a witness against Dale in 2009. "I thought that was a significant matter," Nixon said of the fact that a defence barrister was being used by the prosecution. But Nixon says she was never briefed on the extensive history that precipitated that choice. "I don't recall being told she was a source, ever," she says. Indeed, Nixon says she did not know anything about the Lawyer X scandal until the Herald Sun broke the story in 2014. At the end of 2018, when the High Court decision against Victoria Police was handed down, she thought Lawyer X was another lawyer, perhaps Zara Gard Wilson. Here was the biggest corruption of process in legal history, under the watch of a crusading corruption buster. Yet Nixon says that she did not know what 140 police under her leadership did know. Indeed, Ms. Nixon doesn't seem to know much about some of the biggest crimes that took place during her time as Victoria Police Chief Commissioner between 2001 and 2009. She receives the words Dublin Street, the shorthand for the Hodson Michelle burglary in 2003, with a blank stare. Her subordinates should have sought legal advice about Gobbo's use, she says. She should have been told about Gobbo, she agrees. If she had been, she would have been extraordinarily surprised. Instead, Nixon knew only about the results. She attended a presentation, alongside Premier Steve Brax, about the operation against Mockbell's crew, known as Operation Posse, apparently a high watermark in policing. Yet Nixon was ignorant of the fundamental truths behind that sting, of ethical breaches so profound that the decades-long convictions stemming from the operation stand to be overturned. She doesn't know why she was not told. Perhaps the officers managing the risks felt that the risks were being managed. The same risks, mind you, that explain the need for the Lawyer X Royal Commission. Nixon notes that hindsight is a wonderful thing. The top job sounds like the most culturally isolated position within Victoria Police. The glib conclusion from Nixon's evidence was that the boss needed to know nothing. Nixon stands to be condemned by an oft-repeated line from the New South Wales Wood Royal Commission in the mid-1990s. She used the line in 2001 when she addressed drug squad members and disbanded the unit. Some detectives complained that they were unaware of corrupt colleagues in their midst. Her parting shot to them? If you didn't know, you should have. Christmas must have been strained in the Overland household. After a month to consider his options, Simon Overland has to get back in the witness box, and he has to change his evidence. He has read the belatedly discovered diaries he kept a decade or more ago. In light of what they reveal, Nixon's apparently marginal place in the story will also have to be reconsidered. Was she so irrelevant? On the 21st of January 2020, Overland tells the Commission that it seems from his diary that he briefed Nixon about Gobbo within days of Gobbo's registration as 3838, but he has no memory of ever telling Nixon about their most critical gangland weapon. Overland sounds cornered. Having now reviewed my diary, I note that I was involved in 14 meetings with Ms. Nixon regarding Piranha Task Force matters, and I believe that I did, in fact, inform her of Miss Gobbo's recruitment on the 29th of September 2005. He says, I have no independent recollection of this meeting, but note the contents of my diary entry that indicates I did tell her about the registration of Miss Gobbo as a human source. Overland apologises for his stated belief that he kept no diaries. He says 6 separate requests from Victoria Police for materials did not yield them, triggering his mistaken recollection. He gets emotional when recalling the gangland carnage. Police confronted death and destruction, he says. He remembers the pressures Victoria Police felt at the time. But there is still an elephant in the room. Who knew what and when? Overland has offered no clarity. From the start, his stated evidence has conflicted with the written documentation of events at the time. Winnicky sums it up neatly. Overland's arguments are incongruous. Finn McRae, the director of Victoria Police's legal services, is next in the witness box. His role in the story is muddled. He represents the legal advice that police investigators avoided for so long. His evidence goes to the layered understanding of Gobbo's use at the time and immediately afterwards. McRae came into the circle of knowledge when Gobbo sued police in 2010. He says he discovered she was informing to police at that time, but not that she was informing on her own clients until 2012. At one point, asked about his handling of the marathon issues surrounding Gobbo, McRae begs time to compose himself. He recalls how Gobbo supposedly stabbed herself in the leg with a pen. He gives evidence that echoes the line whispered by anonymous police sources that the Gobbo secret seeped beyond Victoria Police. McRae spoke to John Kane, who headed the Victorian Government Solicitor's Office, about handling Gobbo's 2010 lawsuit claim in a safe way. He provided written advice to Kane that outlined Gobbo's informing history. The two then negotiated a $2.88 million payout aimed at making the informer scandal go away. McRae says Gobbo's informer role was openly discussed at a meeting that included Kane and the Office of Police Integrity. Yet Kane has told the Royal Commission in a statement that he was completely astounded when he discovered Gobbo's informing past 5 years later on reading the 2015 Kellam report. Channeling Overland, he says he was too busy with the Black Saturday Bushfires Royal Commission to be across the details of the written material at the time. What did Kane know and when? No one can say. The Royal Commission cannot call him to the witness box. As Victorian State Coroner, he cannot be compelled to give evidence to the Royal Commission. A gangland barrister, as a gangland snitch, it is unthinkable, McRae protests, even though he has managed much of the fallout for a decade. As Commissioner McMurdo earlier commented, her inquiry is becoming more and more Kafkaesque.